You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 25th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo is brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
Foreign leaders being spied on by U.S. intelligence services. I mean, this has been happening since the U.S. intelligence services were first set up, and people spy on each other. So some of it's for show, but some of it's real. I think they didn't expect the vast extent to what was going on.
NSA spying in Europe, America losing allies abroad, and anniversaries of jailed Russian oligarchs. Robert Fox and Shashank Joshi are here to go over the day's top stories. Then we meet wildlife photographer Nick Brandt, who explains his latest work, Across the Ravaged Land.
I wanted to find a way of capturing the horror of the destruction, taking a photograph of an elephant carcass with its face hacked off and its tusks missing. It was too documentary-like.
And later on, since it's Friday, we'll also have a little bit of this. All that and more coming up for you on Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then on today's programme. Before we get our teeth stuck into all that, let's catch up on the world news here with a full news bulletin. It's David Spencer.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. EU leaders meeting in Brussels have issued a joint statement saying that distrust of the US over spying could harm the fight against terrorism. They said that a lack of trust could prejudice intelligence gathering cooperation. France and Germany are pushing for talks with the US over the issue after allegations emerged this week. That included the bugging of German Chancellor Angela Merkel's phone and claims that the US National Security Agency monitored millions of French telephone calls. British Prime Minister David Cameron has accused US whistleblower Edward Snowden, who's behind the leaks, of assisting Britain's enemies.
We do have to take a sort of cold, hard look at this. As we stand today, there are lots of people in the world who want to do us harm, who want to blow up our families, who want to maim people in our countries. That is the facts. It's not a pleasant fact, but it is true.
The meeting in Brussels has also discussed the immigration crisis that has seen hundreds of people die in the Mediterranean this month alone. But EU leaders stopped short of new emergency measures, saying there would be a review instead in December. Overnight, Italian coast guards rescued hundreds of would-be migrants off the coast of Lampedusa. Vessels were sent to transfer the migrants onto safer coast guard boats and bring them to the port of Lampedusa. Suspected Boko Haram militants have engaged security forces in a lengthy gun battle and raided a hospital in northern Nigeria. Witnesses claim attackers stole drugs from the hospital and drove off in ambulances. Meanwhile, the military said it had killed 74 suspected militants in a raid in Borno State. Authorities have recently stepped up their campaign against the militants. A court in eastern China has rejected an appeal by ousted senior politician Bo Jilai and upheld his life sentence on charges of bribery, corruption and abuse of power. His career was stopped short last year by a murder scandal in which his wife was convicted of poisoning a British businessman, Neil Hayward, who had been a family friend. Bo Jilai was jailed for life in September. UN agencies have announced a large-scale vaccination campaign in Syria and its neighbours, led by UNICEF and the World Health Organization, following reports of an outbreak of polio. WHO said at least 22 people were suspected of having polio in Syria, the first outbreak of the crippling viral disease in 14 years. UNICEF says around 500,000 children in Syria have not been vaccinated in the past 2 years due to the civil war. Spokesperson Marixi Mercado.
The conflict in Syria has caused immense displacement, with millions of children on the move, either inside the country or across borders into neighboring countries and beyond. As a result, routine immunization systems, so critical to preventing childhood diseases, have been disrupted or broken down. Children are now at far higher risk of diseases such as polio and measles.
In a rare move, North Korea has returned 6 South Korean men to their homeland. They were handed over on the border between the two countries earlier. Their names weren't released and details surrounding their detention in the North remain unclear. Officials said the group would be taken to South Korea's spy agency to face questions over their presence in North Korea. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. And of course, there'll be more news from David Spencer at the bottom of the hour. Meanwhile, though, you're listening to Aperitivo here with me, Tom Edwards, on Monocle 24. And we'll be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo. The time here in London is 6 minutes past 1800 hours. That means it's 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the day's news is Robert Fox, defence editor for London's Evening Standard, and Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI. Welcome both of you to the programme. We're going to start the show with a story that has been understandably dominating headlines here in Europe and also, of course, back in the US. America's ongoing snooping on the communications of European leaders and also its citizens from Brazil and Mexico, Germany this week with Angela Merkel. The latest suggestion is the NSA monitored the phone conversations of 35 world leaders. Before we get into that, let's hear from Peter Spiegel of the Financial Times, who we spoke to a little earlier.
Talking to German officials, they do find this to be an egregious breach of trust. And it's hard to tell how much of this is a bit of kabuki dance, because look, be honest, you know, foreign leaders being spied on by U.S. intelligence services. I mean, this has been happening since the U.S. intelligence services were first set up, and people spy on each other. So some of it's for show, but some of it's real. I think they didn't expect the vast extent to what was going on. There is this bit that's getting all the publicity, which is, you know, spying on foreign leader, you know, shock, horror, there's gambling going on in the casino. But there is another issue here that both Hollande and Merkel talked about here at the summit, which is this vast spying operation on average citizens' emails and phone records. And that has been, you know, really their concern here in Europe, as well as in the United States, that spying operation is well beyond anything they knew about, well beyond anything they expected. And so when you hear Hollande and Merkel talk about this, they tend to focus much more on that issue than on the personal listening to leaders. You know, Hollande joked that, you know, he certainly would like if no one listened to phone numbers that you got when you meet a friend at a summit. But to be honest with you, both of them have focused much more on this issue of the hoovering up of vast amounts of email and phone data of average citizens.
That's Peter Spiegel there of the Financial Times talking to us a little earlier. Robert, if I can start with you. Peter suggests there it's this sort of mass observation of citizens rather than the more headline-grabbing snooping on specific world leaders. That's the unacceptable face of sort of intelligence operations. Do you think he's right to suggest that?
I think there's more to it. I think it's quite technical and I think it's quite particular. I've been dealing with French, Anglo-French cooperation on security and foreign policy, particularly in the Gulf, all day. And this has come up time and time again. And the shoe is very much on the other foot. When you've had this series of meetings leading to the Lancaster House Treaty in 2010, that there should be joint cooperation on intelligence, and everybody was always sneered at the French. The French were always, you know, pro-Serbian during the Bosnian conflict and so on. There were certain lapses. So how could you trust the French? The French are making a very, very interesting point, because there is quite a bit of tactical exchange of information, and they have been shocked by Snowden, and it is the sheer range of stuff. And a very senior strategic advisor to the government of France put it to me this way, and he's well used to our ways. He's a frequent flyer at IISS and at its equivalents in the United States. He said, look, the thing that this has revealed is that suppose we are exchanging sort of battlefield information, and it might be about the presence of al-Shabaab or Boko Haram in Mali, for example. And what this means is if it goes through the GCHQ filter, he said, in quotes, and I'm quoting my friend here, saying, it goes to any Tom, Dick and Harry. And that's what Snowden has proved, how insecure and leaky this is and how promiscuous It is, in a way. And that's where Peter Spiegel is absolutely right. The other thing, and there is an Anglophone aspect to this, and the friend put it very, very well, and it's shared by the Germans and the French in particular. It is quite clear that there is one rule for the Five Eyes Club, so-called, and there's one rule for the rest of them. This has knocked back. Let's park. This is where David Cameron was deliberately missing the point today. Let's park where America is, and it's in a very serious situation on this. But just take the UK, where we are, for instance. This has knocked back Anglo-German, Anglo-French relations in disastrously, particularly when Cameron, as we know, is trying to get Merkel on side. Just to finish, though, it's absolutely clear that the suspicion in Paris and Berlin is that Britain was in all this because it's inside the wire and they use GCHQ. Cameron is in more dead trouble than he's letting on.
Well, it's pretty worrying, I would imagine, then, for Cameron if people share that view. Do you think that's an accurate assessment, Shashank? Do you think that, you know, one of the real losers in this could prove to be David Cameron?
I think Robert's put it exceptionally well. I actually think Cameron will succeed in deflecting most of this. I think it'll rebound mostly onto Obama himself. I also think, although this is serious and all of those concerns are sincere, we often hear, I think, a sort of world-weary, everyone knows everyone spies. And I think Robert explained very well that some of the French and German concerns here are about more than that. They're about the leakiness of the GCHQ bureaucracy. Having said that, I think some of the German response is for domestic constituents nonetheless.
Yes.
And therefore that once we have some relatively superficial means of assuaging German and, of course, French concerns, that at least Merkel and Hollande can point to their own domestic constituents as saying, look, we have secured these agreements and these guarantees from our American counterparts. The issue can die down very slightly. But other than that, I think I agree entirely.
So, Robert, when you consider the responses then out of Berlin and out of Paris, do you think Shashank's right? And we are talking about a game of domestic politics in terms of a lot of the rhetoric, at least, and that the underlying concern, the more fundamental problem, is exactly what you said, which may be a distrust of the UK on this.
Well, again, we're in complete agreement. I think it's very interesting how Hollande, which I was talking to people on background and so on, was seeing it. Much more interesting, though, of course, is Angela Merkel. And sorry to put it almost in tabloid terms.
She is
showing herself to be a really class act on this. The way she deflected the personal thing. She's a very private person, as we know, for somebody publicly who's so powerful. She's very private. And the way she batted away the fact that her mobile phone had been involved. But she's positioning herself very, very intelligently. Because remember, Germany is emerging on the global stage in a different, just by stealth, as it were. It's not sneaky, but by stealth. For instance, defense exports to the Gulf. They now have permission to do it. They are coming through very clean as a very honest broker. And I agree. And that's why with Tasha on this, because she hasn't over-egged it. But I read FT Online, Peter's copy, no doubt. She and Hollande are talking about, wonderful word, new protocols in regard to intelligence participation and sharing with their senior partners. The man who's really got to do something and say something intelligent quickly to assuage opinion, although much of his domestic opinion won't care a damn about this, is, of course, Barack Obama.
Absolutely. Shashank, interesting that Rob makes that point there about this sort of new non-aligned movement, if you will, of the irritated European nations.
European now.
What would that look like? Can that work? I mean, is that even a practical thing, or is it just the sort of nicety that you get in the aftermath of this kind of outrage?
No, well, I think these prospective protocols for intelligence sharing are more about appeasing domestic
yes.
constituencies. Having said that, I think the European leaders, both Hollande and Merkel, understand intelligence sharing is absolutely crucial. They may not be members of the Five Eyes group. They may not have access to the full complement of intelligence coming out of those US, British, New Zealand, Australian intelligence sharing channels. But I think they understand it is crucially important to be able to safeguard US intelligence collection and sharing, as well as put it into a box. They don't want to push back so hard that this creates such difficulties that they lose out on very valuable intelligence. Interestingly, the only other country I can see that has soft-pedaled such serious allegations has been India. Brazil nearly cancelled the state visit. India, on the other hand, says it's no big deal. Clearly trying to play it down before it becomes too big in their own domestic sphere, because they know, I think, NSA activities on traffic in India aren't really directed against Indian interests. They're directed against, probably, terrorism interests of mutual concern.
Very interesting that you've raised India in this. One of the most intelligent pieces, happened to be by a friend, a very old friend, is Roger Cohen's piece in the International New York Times today. And he makes a very, very strong point. And it's not only this, I guess it's some of the other things that we're going to look at on the NSA. What it is beginning to show is the downside and the weak side of Obama's famous pivot towards Asia. Because what Roger, who is very well travelled, he knows Europe, but he knows Latin America extremely well. He said the pivot has been a huge mistake if it is now perceived by the bien pensant, the educated, the multi-travelled part of American Beltway Washington and American business and banking opinion, for example, that the pivot away from Europe, and it's part of the temperamental package that you get with Obama, could be semi to possibly very disastrous.
Intriguing. I mean, Shashank, what do you think about that? I mean, we talked a lot about the pivot, then they sort of changed the language somewhat and we ended up in sort of semantic thing about it. But do you think that there are people who are rebalancing? Yeah. Do you think that people will start to say, this was a serious misjudgment, perhaps, by Obama?
Well,
by
I mean, this is a semantic issue. Of course, I see parallels between Europe and the Gulf. The Gulf, of course, is petrified that the US is abandoning the Gulf.
Indeed.
We've seen enormous breaches between the US and Saudi Arabia this week. On the whole, I tend to be incredibly unsympathetic to those in the Gulf who think the US is leaving. I think it most certainly isn't, and they're overinterpreting a number of pretty small actions. I think the same is probably occurring in Europe. Ultimately, I look at something like Libya, where you have desperate French and British calls for intervention. They pull the US in successfully, and then they can barely refuel their own planes without, or even organise the entire thing, without enormous US assistance. I see the same thing on on Syria, where France and the UK try and pull the US in, and then of course the UK falls at the first hurdle, and the French refuse to do it themselves and can only step in tepidly with a few arms. At the end of the day, the US pivot to Asia is exactly that, a rebalancing, a small shift in emphasis, and it doesn't really change the fact that the US is a preeminent actor in both the Middle East and Europe, and will continue to be so, in my view.
I agree with you entirely, but for one thing, and that is the public narrative. And this is where I'm not criticising Obama, I'm not criticising Cameron Hollande or Mrs. Merkel on this. I'm criticising us, and myself in particular. The way the events in Syria, following the events of August the 21st and then the August the 29th debate in the House of Commons, I thought the commentariat really let us down. As I've said here on Monocle before and in my own columns and in the Standard, that they couldn't debate, just as you have raised quite rightly now, what I call second and third order strategic considerations. When that came up in the debate, are you going to strike on Syria? What are you going to do? And then what are the consequences? What are the intended consequences? And if you're doing operational planning, you must have a slot, which is always very difficult to fill, of the unintended consequences. And in discussion of these kinds of things, there isn't much identification of that. So obviously, all the world's a tabloid now. Everybody could talk about Mrs. Merkel's mobile phone being hacked. It is much more complicated than that. And I think there is a huge elephant in this room, a very ghostly cyber elephant.
That's the worst kind.
And it's somebody I think we know very well, Major General Jonathan Shaw, who was the first appointed director of counter-cyber warfare as an assistant chief of the defense staff, said he cannot see there is any golden rubric, any golden regulation, any golden mechanism that can exclude leaks or hacking in this sphere. It is an insecure element, and it is a major part of warfare today. And I think we've got to be realistic, because Snowden, Bradley Manning, they're not the last. They may be among the first, and there may be many, many more.
And the next ones may not be American.
Absolutely.
Exactly so.
Interestingly, if we talk about the leaks that may be there, how porous these things can be, sometimes one wonders if some people in the American administration don't do the most to help themselves. We had this sort of extraordinary story revealed today of the former CIA and NSA director Michael Hayden, who, as is put here in The Guardian, was on the wrong end of a surveillance stakeout inadvertently, enjoying some discreet conversation, shall we say, and his words were immediately being broadcast to the world on Twitter by someone who was sitting in the adjacent seat next to him. Obviously, eventually Hayden was then cautioned that this news was getting out.
What I thought was wonderful about the story is I remember a few weeks ago, the story the Indian High Commission here in London had stopped using their computers, using typewriters instead, and the ambassador himself was going out to the garden to have these conversations. And I thought, this is not some new novel way to escape surveillance. This is something out of the 1960s, some awful Cold War counterintelligence technique you've learned. Yeah. As if actually being outside makes you immune from spying. No, it most certainly doesn't. There's probably more likely to be a bug in the bush than a bug in your laptop, I think.
But are you surprised, Robert? I mean, you've seen, I mean, I'm sure various people in Hayden's sorts of roles come and go over the years. I mean, that's indiscretion on a new and especially stupid level, isn't it?
Yeah, come on, Tom. This is the way you and I live. The thing that I can never get over. I've been 46 years a journalist, and I cannot get over the vanity of big mouth. People do love blabbing off when they shouldn't do. And he got caught by Twitter. You're absolutely right. And it is my generation, as Mr. Hayden is, you know, that we're so naive about this. You know, I still love the fact, because I do the old-fashioned thing, a bit of the eyeball contact, go out with the old notebook and the pencil and interview people, and people are always saying off the record, and I shouldn't be telling you this. I mean, if it's a story, it's a story. Why on earth are you saying it? And this is it. This is pure vanity.
Robert, it's one thing telling you in the Travellers Club. It's another thing telling you on the tube.
Yes. Well, the trouble is that I'm a member of the Garrick, and you get drummed out of the brownies if you mention it there.
It's not just the NSA, of course. It sort of chimes with this story we had earlier this week. Director of the non-proliferation section of the National Security Staff within the White House, who'd been, again, surreptitiously leaking this kind of information on Twitter.
Extraordinary invective spewing from his account.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, again, is it just incredible naivety on his behalf? I mean, surely these people now realise that they are going to be found out, however alluring it is to broadcast these truths out there. They're going to be found out. Why do you think they do it, Shashank?
Well, absolutely the case. I'm of the Twitter and Facebook generation. The year I started university, Facebook appeared. So I've grown up with it in my sort of adult life in some sense. And it has always inculcated an incredibly false sense of comfort. All of your network feels like you were trading information with a small, close-knit family of people. And of course, that's not at all the case. I have, you know, a few thousand Twitter followers, but you speak on it as though you might be speaking to a group of friends. So naturally, you were lulled into making these incredibly, you know, sometimes juvenile comments you wouldn't dream of making in a radio studio or to a journalist or anything like that.
It's fascinating stuff. You're with Aperitivo here. With me, Tom Edwards. That was Shashank Joshi from RUSI. We're still here with Robert Fox as well from London Evening Standard. When we come back just after this, the three of us will talk a little about Russia. Stay tuned.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If we're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. 24 minutes past 1800 hours. Still with me is Robert Fox, Defence Editor for London's Evening Standard, and Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at RUSI. Gentlemen, let's turn and look to Russia now. A story of, well, perhaps that country's most famous prisoner, certainly probably the most famous current prisoner. 10 years, of course, since Mikhail Khodorkovsky, formerly the head of UKOS, the big oil giant, was arrested, sentenced to 7 years on fraud and tax evasion charges. His sentence was nearing an end. Some more years were tacked on for good measure, this time embezzlement, money laundering. He's sort of gone from being one of the early oligarchs to being a long-term political prisoner. It's an extraordinary story, and there's an op-ed piece in the New York Times today which makes incredible reading. It reminds you, this is a man who's been incarcerated for 10 years on what is widely regarded as being rather trumped up charges. Shashank, when you read a piece like that, what's your response? Does it still strike you as extraordinary that a man like this can have been denied his liberty, shunted from one outpost of Russia to another, and quite often it seems to just pass the rest of the world by?
I think there's two responses I have. One of them is to say, I like the irony of a few weeks after Vladimir Putin used the New York Times as a mouthpiece for his own views on Syria, appealing to the international community and Americans in their own terms, Khodorkovsky has done the same. And I love the fact he's done it in the same pages with the same erudition, even more erudition, I think, in just the right terminology. His case is understated. He doesn't say that the Russians are torturing people on a massive scale. He doesn't need to say that. He just says his own story and the facts are clear. His case, of course, is a relatively mild one when we consider that the Russians have killed people, of course. Mm. I think what the second reaction to this essay is, that there's a very, he explicitly invokes Nelson Mandela. He focuses on the need for reconciliation with what follows, on the possibility of grand rapprochement between Russia and Western Europe on the other hand. How fanciful is all of this? I don't see Putin's Russia as holding any of these possibilities. And his essay is full of hope, and hope that I think is completely at odds with the reality of what is a relatively resilient regime, at least for the foreseeable future.
Now, Robert, would you go along with that? Is this just sadly, a mere flight of fancy, and it will never amount to anything more?
I think it's a great testament. I think it's very important that these things are done, because my mind started flicking back to the great, wonderful Anton Chekhov going to see the prisoners in Sakhalin, the Gulag Archipelago, one day in the life of Ivan Ivanisevich. He's borne witness, and he's there. Okay, we don't know. By the way, if he does write like this, he's got a great, great book in him, you know, and really up there with, you know, my hero of Russian reporters, Vasily Grossman. And this is the quality, because he's got the pathos. He's obviously highly cultured, as we've just heard, because he understates rather than overstates. That's actually very, very good reporting. As you know, if you've got a great, great story, the story tells itself. And he makes very humane and absolutely correct flicks in the direction of Pussy Riot and so on, says how awful this is. And of course, it's a complete outrage. And he ends up rather Chekhov-like, in a Chekhovian way, in looking through all the bleakness for hope, because he says we are a great culture and we have to look at this way. But, you know, that really from the op-ed, and I absolutely agree with Shashank here, is how you get beyond Putin, because Putin seems to love this sort of grand guignol figure that he has become, a sort of mixture between Jack Nicholson as the Joker, and I'm quite serious about this, and Ivan the Terrible or Boris Godunov. I am the necessary tyrant, he seems to be saying. Otherwise, these great lands, plural, will not hold together. And it's a very frightening prospect, because he has proved crucial in the very delicate state of things in the Middle East, particularly regarding Syria, but may well prove so over Iran and even with Turkey. But if you have somebody of such extremes, of such cynicism, and that's the great case that Khodorkovsky makes in this point, makes it in this piece, you know, how can you deal with this guy, particularly as it now looks as if this guy is going to be the principal supporter
of maintaining Bashar al-Assad in power. And Bashar al-Assad looks as if he is going to be in power for quite a long time.
Absolutely. Shashank, it is amazing, isn't it? Robert makes that point very well there about how eloquent. We both talked about the understatement, the potency of his writing. He may have a great book in him. One wonders perhaps if the world will ever see it.
By the way.
Well, I mean, this is another question altogether. I just wondered, though, if he talks about this project of stagnation in Russia that needs an ambitious European alternative. You talk about how that's kind of pie in the sky. With all of this eloquence and no seeming prospect of any real outlet for it, what is the alternative? I mean, is Robert right? We're doomed to more Putin and all of his various misdeeds internationally and domestically, supposedly. Is there any other alternative? What other actors perhaps could influence the situation?
Well, I think this is one of his most interesting points, which is it's not just about Putin. Putin has changed the system as a whole and reduced the number and the strength of democratic stakeholders in it. I think the most interesting question for me in terms of what could affect the resilience of that horrific regime in the longer term is oil prices and the shale revolution. And I'm most hopeful that that is what will slowly chip away at the bedrock of modern Russian power over the past 10 years, that is what will eventually reduce the Russian capacity state to buy off dissent and buy coercive power.
It could be a story played out in minerals once again. Shashank Joshi, Robert Fox, thank you both very much indeed for joining me here at Midori House today.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's aperitivo. We'll meet and preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily, amongst other things. Before we get started on all of that, here's David Spencer with the World News headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. European leaders have warned that distrust of the United States over spying allegations could harm the fight against terrorism. Leaks from former NSA contractor Edward Snowden apparently showed the US monitored German Chancellor Angela Merkel's mobile phone. And there have been allegations of widespread phone monitoring in France. Talks in Brussels have also focused on the migration crisis affecting the Mediterranean. But while leaders expressed deep sadness at the deaths of more than 500 migrants this month alone, they postponed any new action until December. Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto has been ordered to attend all sessions of his trial at the International Criminal Court unless specifically excused. Ruto is accused of orchestrating a wave of violence after Kenya's contested 2007 election. DNA tests have shown that a Bulgarian Roma couple are the biological parents of a four-year-old blonde girl found in a Roma camp in Greece last week. Bulgarian prosecutors are investigating whether the mother agreed to sell her child, something she denies. At least 22 people, most of them babies and toddlers, are now believed to have contracted polio in Syria. The World Health Organization and UNICEF is launching an immunization process in Syria and its neighbours. And some news that has particularly saddened Tom today. The world's tallest dog has died at the age of 7 at his home in Tucson, Arizona. Great Dane Giant George weighed in at more than 17.5 stone and was able to reach a height of 7'3" standing on his hind legs. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. It was a dark day indeed for Great Dane aficionados. I always like it when they say a height of 7'3" standing on his hind legs, as if he would maybe strike that pose now and again, possibly strolling around on his hind legs, maybe, I don't know, wearing a top hat, carrying a cane, something like that.
If I could reach 7'3", I would do it as often as I could. But a very sad day in the canine world.
Worth looking up some pictures of Giant George if you get the opportunity. He was a handsome devil.
His owner was too.
They were a good-looking couple. Thank you very much indeed, David. More news of that and more serious types, no doubt, as well at the top of the next hour. You're with Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. It's 18:33 in London, 15:33 in Rio. It's time now to meet wildlife photographer and conservationist Nick Brent, who just opened this week at Atlas Gallery in London the third and final instalment of his trilogy on the natural landscapes and native wildlife of East Africa.
His latest work, Across the Ravaged Land, is though far darker than his previous assignments, along with beautiful somber pictures of animals. It depicts the destruction of the sub-Saharan part of the continent. He met with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco a little earlier. Fernando asked him how this final piece of the trilogy differs from his previous work.
When I began photographing in Africa in 2001, I still saw the place as a kind of paradise, as a kind of Garden of Eden, the natural world. And then over the years, as the destruction of that natural world and the animals that live within it began to escalate, I could no longer ignore that. And so the trilogy of books over the successive years, ending with the latest, Across the Ravaged Land, has a kind of arc from paradise to destruction.
What's been your involvement with wildlife and conservation in general?
I've always had an obsession with animals and the natural world and the environment, and I was always looking for a way to express creatively my feelings about it. And when I went to Africa in the mid-90s, late-90s, I suddenly realized that through photography I could express my feelings about it. And then with the conservation, it was kind of an inevitable, unavoidable drive towards that, because this world that I love so much is being destroyed so fast and escalating out of control in the last 4 or 5 years, to the point at which we're looking at a kind of apocalypse of destruction of the natural world across the African continent.
Let's talk a little bit more about your latest work here, which is going to be the main theme of the exhibition, Across the Ravaged Land. I can see the pictures of the book here in front of me, and they're quite dark in tone. Why is that?
As I said, you know, there's this apocalypse of destruction. Right now, we're both looking at a photo of 22 rangers who are holding the tusks of elephants killed at the hands of man in the Amboseli-Tsavo ecosystem, 2004 to 2009. And some of these tusks, well, the tusks being held by the ranger at the front of the photo, they look about 7-8 feet from the ground. And I doubt there is an elephant left alive today on the African continent with tusks that size. They have all been killed by poachers. And in China, tusks that size would probably fetch somewhere in the region of $500,000 now. And that's the kind of battle we're facing.
And also, why did you decide to add humans on your pictures as well? Because I believe in your previous work you didn't. So that's quite a new thing for you.
Well, the rangers holding these tusks are protectors. They're not destroyers. They are rangers that belong to Big Life Foundation, which is a foundation I started to help protect this 2 million acre ecosystem in Amboseli in East Africa 3 years ago. I wanted to find a way of capturing the horror of the destruction, but it's just taking a photograph of an elephant carcass with its face hacked off and its tusks missing wasn't sufficiently kind of, it was too documentary-like. So these kind of images that we're looking at with these rangers holding the tusks is, there's a sort of grieving, perhaps, that you would interpret it as going on, but also a kind of sense of readying for battle. Maybe I'm kind of, you know, putting too much on the images, and it's up to the viewer to decide how they interpret them.
There are other images that I'm quite curious about. The one with a trophy head, there's a lion. Where did you find this?
So, yeah, there's a series of photographs I did of former hunters' trophies that I took and placed on posts back in the landscapes where once these animals used to roam. And what I try to do is take photographs of these animals like they are portraits of animals alive again in death. So that when the lion, in that photograph of the lion you're talking about, I hope you get the feeling that he's looking out across the landscape where once he roamed almost wistfully. There's a sort of almost an emotion in the face, even though it's a decapitated head.
But anyways, I have to say it's fascinating photographies. And also, Nick, what's next for you? Are you still going to be in East Africa, or are you already thinking about your next plans?
It's kind of become my mission in life, I think, now to document the world of animals, the natural world, the environment, and the destruction of all those elements. I think for now it will continue to be in Africa. I don't know how exactly. After the trilogy, I'm not worrying about it right now. I just am relieved to have gotten to the end of this cycle of this trilogy.
That was the photographer Nick Brandt discussing his wonderful pictures of African wildlife with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Up next on Aperitivo, we look back at a Spanish singer who defined an era and maybe even a country. Stay tuned for more on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living begins hitting shelves around the world, our editors take to the roads to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors, and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping, and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're heading in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. Now, Manolo Escobar, the Spanish singer whose song Viva España became a best-selling single during the transition from Franco-era dictatorship to democracy in the 1970s, has died. He was 82. Well, joining me now to pass through Escobar's legacy is Jesus Ruiz Mantilla from El País Semanal, and also Carlos Alba, journalist and author of the novel The Songs of Manolo Escobar. Jesus, if I can start with you, just tell us a little bit about what exactly Manolo Escobar means to Spain, and what news of his passing today, what reaction will that be bringing out back home in Spain?
Hi, hello. Well, Manolo Escobar is kind of a soundtrack of a lifetime here, you know. It's a kind of a Spain that we almost, when democracy came, we almost tried to forget about, but it was impossible, because it was a kind of soundtrack of nostalgia that made company to all of us during the lifetime. No, it's curious because you see him like the Spain you don't want to be part of, but you can't help to be part of it, you know. And it's the strength of his popular tunes and the strength of getting to the hearts of people and going to, and getting all to the joy of the people, you know.
Absolutely.
He was joyful, you know. He was very you know, funny and joyful and kind of a party thing, you know.
So, absolutely. So the joy of his music, I think, is clear to people who listen. Carlos, yeah. If I can come to you, Jesus says there that the soundtrack of a lifetime, if you like. Is that how you feel about Manolo Escobar? And is that perhaps why your novel, The Songs of Manolo Escobar, was sort of viewed, if you like, through a prism in many ways of his music?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I grew up as a Spaniard living outside of Spain I was a child in the 60s and 70s, and my grandmother used to come to the UK to where we lived, and she used to bring cassettes and records by Manolo Escobar, and that the house was full of them, and at a time when there weren't that many cultural references coming out of Spain. You know, this was a time when Spain was still a dictatorship, and you know, a lot of the artistic and musical output from Spain was heavily censored, and there really wasn't that much of it around. But Manolo Escobar's songs were, you know, as familiar to me growing up in Scotland as to anyone in Spain. And you know, Jesus talks about you know, about him being a kind of party singer, and that's so true. You know that there are fathers and uncles the world over who, after they've had a few glasses of wine and they fancy themselves as a bit of a singer, you know, we'll still belt out, you know, Perón Pom Pom and Viva España and all these great, you know, Manolo Escobar favourites.
Absolutely. Well, as a tribute to Manolo Escobar, and indeed, I think you're right, Carlos, to some of those drunken uncles, let's hear a little bit of one of his most famous and recognisable songs now.
Entre flores, fandanguillo y alegría, nació mi España, la tierra del amor. Por eso se oye este refrán, que viva España.
That is, of course, Viva España. Jesus, I just wondered, I wanted to pick up on that sense of perhaps a draw over people, that maybe it was something they didn't want to remember, didn't want to go back to, a different part of life in Spain, but that in a way, through Manolo Escobar, it was inevitable. They were drawn back, even though they weren't sure that's what they wanted. Do you think that will be reflected when we look at the newspapers today and tomorrow in how he's remembered? Do you think there will be some sense of conflict, or will it all be positive? It'll all be happiness, remembering that party spirit that you mentioned?
Because I think through the decades now of democracy, that we have recognized with that part of that maybe the modern Spain didn't want to be part of it. And it's funny, because I started to appreciate Manolo Escobar when I was away from Spain, you know, right into England, you know, when I first traveled to England and made sure that singing Porón Pompero and all that kind of songs were kind of joyful identity of being a Spaniard out of Spain. You know, you couldn't help it. So I think we all have recognized, because it's been, you know, he's been a very very simple man in a positive way. He was he wasn't at all weird or a superb, you know. He was a kind and very accessible and very good man, you know, in the sense of being a good man and being an open and just a very simple and very kind of simple man, you know.
Absolutely, Jesus. I think that seems to be how he'll be remembered. Carlos, if I can just come to you very briefly for a last word. You've obviously sort of, in a way, commemorated him already through your novel. What's your view of what his kind of legacy will be from a musical point of view and from a cultural point of view? Do you think that the songs and work of Manolo Escobar will indeed sort of continue to permeate all these different strands of Spanish culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, I mean, I think the interesting thing about him was that, you know, he became famous in the 1960s when, as we said before, Spain was still a dictatorship. And, you know, he could have been simply kind of dismissed as, you know, as an establishment figure, somebody who was, you know, who was safe and trusted by the Franco regime. But I think, you know, he managed to reinvent himself. And you know, even as recently as 2010, when Spain won the World Cup, you know, it was Manolo Escobar who sat next to King Juan Carlos in the stadium in South Africa when Spain lifted the trophy, and he re-recorded his famous, you know, song of Viva la España with the Spanish World Cup squad. And so, you know, he was still seen by this generation as being one of the, if not the, you know, kind of iconic cultural figures in Spain.
Wonderful memories there of Manolo Escobar, who died today, from Carlos Alba, the journalist and author, and before that from Jesus Ruiz Mantilla from El País Semanal. Next up, let's get a bit of contemporary Spanish music. Staying in the same country, though, but bringing it up to date a little, this is Spirit by DeLorean. That was Spirit by DeLorean here on Aperitivo on Monocle 24. Now, we are fast approaching the end of this evening's programme. Before we go, though, time to have a look at what's coming up on tonight's other great shows here on the station. I'm joined now in Studio One by Daphne Denis and Annabelle Bly, producers, respectively, of course, of the Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. Daphne, let's start with you. What's going to be happening on the Globalist Asia tonight?
Oh, many, many things. I'm quite excited, I have to say.
Good.
We're going to start by talking about the new Entente Cordiale, I like to speak in French sometimes, between China and the EU. And we're going to ask what they can get from each other. We'll be speaking to our woman in Brussels, Charlotte MacDonald Gibson. But the very, very exciting bit that we're going to have is a long segment on the Tokyo Olympic Stadium and how they've had to sort of downsize their Olympic hopes, their great expectations. It sounds like they may have to sort of reorganize the financing of it because it seems very expensive. And we'll be talking to the man in charge of the project, Jim Heverin at Zaha Hadid, and as well to an international Olympic historian.
Fantastic stuff. I'm looking forward to hearing about that in more detail, Daphne. Are we got some? I think we do. We have other voices even on that. It's a huge mixed debate, really.
Yes, we have also spoken to obviously our Tokyo bureau chief Fiona, and this is what she said.
Well, the latest is that today the Olympic minister Hakobun Shimomura said that Japan will go ahead with this 80,000 capacity stadium. The design is by Zaha Hadid, London-based architect. Now, the original budget was 130 billion yen, which is obviously enormous already. That's $1.3 billion. But this week, at a budgetary meeting at the Diet, Shimomura revealed that actually the costs were likely to go up to $3 billion. Obviously, just, you know, an insane amount of money. And I think a lot of people felt, really, is this feasible at this point in Japan's, you know, with everything going on in Japan, is this really the right thing to do? So I think there will be scaling back, but they'll stick to the outline. I mean, at the moment, it's just not clear how much the scaling back will be.
Fascinating debate. Lots of big names joining the Globalist Asia team. Daphne Denis will be presiding over that a little later. That's at 2000 hours, of course. A little later than that, at 2200, Annabelle Bly will be steering the good ship Monocle Daily. What will be on board the vessel this evening, Annabelle?
I've again got a very busy show. We'll be starting off by talking about the spillover of the Syrian conflict into Lebanon. So we will have a correspondent in Lebanon talking to us about the latest fighting that's spilled over into the north of Lebanon, into Tripoli.
Because, of course, the spillover, as you say, has been concerning people almost as much as the events on the ground within the country. Latest on that, that'll be a fascinating analysis. Any other treats in store for us on the show?
Yeah, well, the other big story is we'll be looking at the upcoming Chilean elections, having a profile of the somewhat surprised candidate of an ex-TV host, Franco Parisi. But it's not all politics on the Monocle Daily tonight. We'll have a fun Friday night in Istanbul with our new bureau chief over there, Sophie Grove. And we'll also be looking at some art around the world.
What more could you ask for than that? Do you know what, Annabelle? Art around the world, the show, sounds like a work of art. Indeed.
You're too kind, Tom.
Well, you know, I do my best. And it will be exciting to hear what exactly Sophie Grove gets up to on a Friday night in Istanbul. I'm sure a number of her colleagues will be very intrigued to hear. That was Daphne Denis talking about the Globalist Asia and Annabelle Bly talking about the Monocle Daily. That is, sadly, all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. Special thanks in particular to my guests, Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard, and to Shashank Joshi as well. He's a research fellow at RUSI, of course. Let's hear from Shashank. This is what he had to say about the often comical ways that diplomats and others evade modern electronic surveillance.
this is not some new novel way to escape surveillance. This is something out of the 1960s, some awful Cold War counterintelligence technique you've learned. As if actually being outside makes you immune from spying. No, it most certainly doesn't. There's probably more likely to be a bug in the bush than a bug in your laptop, I think.
That's the words of Shashank Joshi, speaking earlier on today's show, which was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Alexa Firmnich, Maddie Arouge and Harriet Thorpe. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up, we've got The Menu, Monocle's food and drink show. We'll be discovering, amongst other things, a harborside complex of restaurants, bars and a jazz club in Copenhagen, partly dreamt up by one of the founders of Noma. All that and more on The Menu. Stay tuned for that. This show will be back at the same time on Monday. But for this edition of Aperitif TiVo from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thanks for tuning in.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.